Welcome on behalf of the Library of JTS to our book talk with Ilana Sasson, her Arabic translation and commentary of Yefet Ben Eli on the Book of Proverbs. When you got in touch with me, I remember to say how excited you were about the publication. I immediately asked you if you'd like to do a book talk, because I had the privilege actually of being involved when you were working on the manuscripts and transcribing and working with a group on Judeo-Arabic and the translation and so forth. So that was really a wonderful part of, education for me. And Ray Shenlin participated, right? I mean, it was really...
It was an amazing group.
It was really super that you helped to convene that. And, also reading through these commentaries. I mean, learning something about Yefet Ben Eli and the Karaite tradition, as expressed here, some of the polemical pieces and so forth. So, it was really a privilege, and this is really, an insight into a part of a Jewish experience that so few people know about. Maybe, I think more people should know about. So we look forward to what you have to share.
Okay.
And I'm just, I'll put this on a chair here, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure. So thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. And I'm going to divide this talk into four sections. So Yefet Ben Eli was a Karaite, so I would like to give an introduction to the Karaite movement. And then I'll talk about Yefet Ben Eli himself and his work. And then I will talk about the making of a critical edition. And then I will bring some samples of, the contents of his commentary. So with regard to the Karaite movement, the precursors of the Karaite movement were all sorts of fringe movements or sectarian movements within the Jewish communities under Islam in Iraq and Iran, and they started to emerge around the 8th century. Most of the information that we have about them is from Kirkisani, who was a Karaite who lived in Iraq in the 9th century. So it's based on his descriptions. And these fringe groups were very influenced by Islam, and they had all sorts of, each one had different agenda. But the common denominator for all of them was the fact that they rejected the oral tradition. And I said most of them were fringe movements, but one of them was actually coming from the center, that was the Annanites. But the Annanites are not Karaites, these are still precursors. So about 100 years later, by the beginning of the 9th century, all this, whatever was left from this movement, was organized and united into the first time we hear about the Karaites. And so the Karaites draw from these different movements, different ideas. For instance, one of the movements was very Zionistic and believed that the Jews should immigrate to the land of Israel to hasten the arrival of the Messiah, and the Karaites incorporated this into their ideology also. And also they incorporated a lot of what Anan ben David was saying and teaching the Annanite movement. Anyway, by the 9th century, we have two charismatic figures. One is Benjamin al-Nahawandi, and the other one is Daniel al-Kumisi. And between the two of them, this movement is coalesced. And a lot of them do immigrate to the land of Israel and settle in Jerusalem. Some less settle in Tiberias, some in Ramle. But in Jerusalem becomes a center for Karaites. They build yeshivot, academies, and they start to produce a lot of literature. So, as I said, the Karaites also rejected the oral tradition. This was their main hallmark. So their rejection wasn't a wholesale rejection. The rejection was not strictly the oral tradition. The rejection was the divine authority of the oral tradition. It was easier for them to look at the Talmud and the Mishnah as if this is another interpretation of the Bible. And so some of it they accepted and some of it they didn't. They were a reform movement, and therefore they were looking they were looking at problems in halacha, and the problems they were looking at were all those gray zones where we don't have a distinct answer in the Bible, and we have to interpret. So these are the same, very similar questions to what the Sadducees were raising. So that's why a lot of people were trying to see connection between the Sadducees and Karaites, but really nobody could prove that they're connected to them, except that they're dealing with similar questions. So because the Karaites looked at the Bible as the source, the only source of halacha, they needed to study the Bible very, very carefully. So they were they knew Hebrew very well. They studied Hebrew. They studied lexicography. They studied and wrote on Masorah and grammar, and wrote translations of the Bible into Arabic, because at the time, by the 9th century, the Jews under Islam couldn't understand Hebrew and couldn't understand the Aramaic translation, so they needed translations into Arabic. And they wrote commentaries, but they also wrote other books. They wrote books of precepts, they wrote philosophy, and even poetry. We know that Yefet ben Eli must have written poetry. I don't know that it was found, but we know that he wrote. At the time, not only the Karaites had to switch to translations in Arabic, also Rabbinate Jews, and we know that Sadia Gaon translated the Bible to Arabic. But the translations are very different, and I will get to this. So the 9th century marks the beginning of the golden age of the Karaites, and it lasted for about 200 years. After that, at the year 1099, there was a crusade that destroyed Jerusalem, and the Karaite community was basically destroyed. Some of them moved to Fustat, Old Egypt, Old Cairo, and joined an older community that was there of Karaites. The Karaites in Fustat, the original Karaites in Fustat, was an affluent community that was very well connected to the authorities, so they helped their people from Jerusalem. But some fled north to Byzantium, and those Karaites lost the ability to understand Arabic, and their literary work was basically translations of whatever was written in Arabic was translated into Hebrew, and that was their contribution. And slowly from Byzantium, they migrated north, further north. They got to Poland, into Russia, into Crimea, and up until today we have the communities of Karaites in those areas. The Karaites that lived in Egypt lived near the Rabbinite community and were very integrated. They felt like they were really part of the same, you know, they were felt part of the same community. Whereas those who migrated eventually to Europe kept separate from Rabbinite Jews. But it's interesting that when the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of those Karaites, some of them came to the land of Israel and joined the Egyptian Karaites who migrated to Israel, and I've seen them. They live together happily. I just wanted to mention a few things about Karaite halacha, just to give you a taste of the differences and on things that they found important. So I'll start with the calendar. So as far as the calendar is concerned, Rabbinite Jews developed very elaborate mathematical computations to decide on this very complicated calendar that we have. But the Karaites said, no, this is not good. We need to go and observe nature. So Rosh Chodesh has to be observed and not calculated. There is another thing in Rabbinite Halacha where Yom Kippur cannot fall on Friday or Sunday. So therefore, every year is adjusted so that Rosh Hashanah falls on a certain day of the week, so that to ensure that Karaite said, no, this is, we don't believe in this, it's not biblical, we're gonna, it falls whenever it falls. So that makes the calendar different. Once a calendar is different for two groups, that's not a good sign. Another thing that they, another thing about calendar, Memohorat HaShabbat, is this Shabbat? Do you know what the issue is? So how do we count? You know that Shavuot falls 7 weeks after Pesach. How do we count the 7 weeks, the 49 days? So it says in the Bible, Memohorat HaShabbat, the day after the Sabbath. Now, some understand Sabbath as Shabbat, as the real Shabbat, meaning the Shabbat that falls sometime, the first Shabbat that falls on Pesach. And therefore, if you start counting from the day after Shabbat, Shavuot, 7 weeks later, will always fall on Sunday, right? But if, but Rabbinite Jews understand it differently. They say Shabbat means holiday, because holiday is also a Shabbat. So they count it from the first day, right? The first day of Pesach. So therefore, Shavuot falls on any other day of the week, whenever, right? So that's the difference. By the way, Christian, the Pentecost is the same holiday. It always falls on Sunday because they followed the Sadducees that also decreed that way. So that's very interesting. Another thing with that has to do with the calendar is, first of all, the Karaites abolished Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyot. In other words, no second Seder, no eighth day of Pesach. No eighth day of Sukkot, no second day of Shavuot. Perfect, right? I would join them any day. They don't celebrate any post-biblical holidays. They don't celebrate Hanukkah, although the community in Israel does celebrate Hanukkah, just because everybody else in Israel, they all do. So also, they didn't used to celebrate Bar Mitzvah, and now they do also. So that's as far as the calendar. I think these are the main things. Now they have a different understanding of that's your domain. What do we do with milk and meat? How to interpret Lo tevashel gdi b'chalev imo? Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. So their understanding is it's most literal. It's like that kid and that's its mother, its biological mother. You're not supposed to mix, but you could take that kid and cook it in the milk of another mother, not its own mother. So in order to avoid and not to, just to protect themselves from inadvertently cooking the kid in its own mother's milk, they, in the same meal, they will eat meat from, let's say, goat and milk from a cow, so that's okay. Another thing is their laws of consanguinity. Again, they are much more strict than Rabbinite Jews. They use a principle called in Arabic qiyas, which is a translation of the Hebrew hekesh, meaning analogy. If it says in the Bible that a man should not marry his aunt, then they deduce from this that a woman shouldn't marry her uncle, which is not a biblical restriction. So they put more and more and more restrictions by way of analogy, to the point that by the 11th century they couldn't find any eligible marriage partners and they had to have a reform. They also have this thing where it says in the Bible, I think in Genesis chapter 4, where does it say that it says about Adam, or it says that a man cleaves to a man's wife and they become one flesh. So they understand it as if they become relatives. So then according to them, if there's a couple married, then his brother cannot marry her sister because they become relatives. So that also, it's another restriction. In general, the Karaites were more strict with their halacha, and maybe this is one of the reasons why their movement couldn't really ever have big numbers. Another thing is prayer. So there are debates in Jewish tradition whether people should pray once, three times or two times a day. Rabbinite Jews went with three times. Karaites decided two times is good for them. The prayer book. The prayer book was based at the beginning on Psalms. They consider Psalms as, you know, Jewish prayers, and why not use them? With time, their prayer book became, like ours, became bigger and bigger, and more and more and more things got included, and never take anything out. So now their prayer book is just as big. They also have PU team. They used to not have PU team, but now they do. They wear a talit, but they don't use tefillin, and they don't put mezuzot. They understand the marking on the doorposts. Or no, they don't use tefillin, right? Because they understand it metaphorically. It's not something you put physically. So this is just the samples of their halacha. And now let me start talking about Yefet ben Eli. We don't really know much about Yefet. We don't know much about people that lived in the Middle Ages because they didn't write about themselves. Nobody else wrote about them. We know by his name that his family is probably from Basra, Iraq, south of Iraq. We don't know if he was born there or not, but we know that he lived and worked in Jerusalem, wrote in Arabic, spoke Arabic. And we know that he lived a long life, and that's because on some of the manuscripts it says, you know, when it says that something is attributed to him, it says it has a little blessing, and there is a different blessing for a living person as opposed to somebody who is dead. And you can see if you can date the manuscript, you can tell. And I think that there is a manuscript from 1008 that he was still considered alive, and that people figure that he must have been at least 90 when he died. But look, it took a long time he translated the entire Bible and wrote commentary on the entire Bible, in addition to other things that he wrote. They figured it took him 30 years to do the Bible. So it's a long time. He has a son. I mean, we know of a son of his, Levi ben Yefet, who eventually lived in Egypt and was a scholar of his own merit. I think that his Book of Precepts, parts of it, were found in Gnizot. Yefet was very revered teacher in the Karaite community, and attestation of this is, I think that there are about 800 manuscripts attributed to him that are found in the the Hebrew University manuscript,
actual manuscripts, or
I mean, not that he wrote, but there are attributed copies of his work, 800 copies of his work. And nowadays Yefet is the most studied Karaite scholar also. Let me just talk a little bit about his style of writing. So Yefet, it's not unique to Yefet, and it's not even unique to Karaites. It's unique, maybe, to that generation, that period. I can say the same thing about Saadia Gaon, the way they write. So they have a tradition of written literature as opposed to oral, oral transmission. So it's very, their commentaries are very different from, if you look at the Talmud as a commentary or Midrash. Everything has an order. Things have an introduction and an epilogue, and they go by an order. If they are to write a commentary on the Bible, they're going to start with Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and work their way all the way to the end in an orderly fashion. Then the identity of the author is known, of course. It's not like Midrash, where we don't know. That's more or less. And let me talk now about the making of the critical edition. So I started with about, I found about 30 manuscripts that had some part of Yefet's commentary on Proverbs. I did not use all of them because some of them were not written so clearly, some of them were not bound in the right order, some of them were too short, and some of them were too identical to others, so they didn't contribute any information, any additional information. So I used only 15 manuscripts, and they can be divided into three major groups. One is only one manuscript, and that's a manuscript from written in the 11th century. That one is written in Arabic characters, belongs to the British Library. Then the next group is, and you're familiar with it, you're smiling. next one is and I don't have anything between the 11th century and the 15th century. 15th century is the next batch. And then we have something from the 17th century and then from the 19th century. And most of the manuscripts are from the 17th century and most of them belong to the St. Petersburg Library. But we do have one copy from the JTS Library, the Adler. This is from the 7th century. It's a full, it has the entire text. It's two volumes. It's written beautifully. It has a little bit of water damage on it. It was copied. The manuscript that I found from the 19th century is a copy of that one. And also the scribe that wrote the 19th century copy also filled in whenever there were pages missing in the JTS. So it's interesting because the early manuscripts from the 15th and from the 17th century are written in semi-cursive, but the one in the 19th century is written in very cursive writing. And apparently that was the trend. Maybe you know more about this, that they wanted to save on writing material and space and work and handwork. So that was the shift. And that makes it a little more difficult to read, but get used to it. So I used 15 manuscripts. Now, because I had one that was written in... No, so first, the first question that I had to deal with is... Am I going to write a diplomatic edition or an eclectic edition? The difference is diplomatic meaning based on one diploma, one manuscript, or am I going to take different parts from different, whichever I think is best from every segment and create an edition? Well, I thought that a diplomatic edition is more of the correct way to go about it. And then, so I had to decide which manuscript to use for that. Of course, I could take one of the later manuscripts and use it, but I really, really wanted to reflect that old 11th century manuscript, and so I wanted to base the edition on that. The problem with that was that it only covered about half the material. So I used it, and then I filled in with other manuscripts. I filled in mostly from the manuscript from the 15th century that I thought that was second best, and whatever I didn't find there, I took from the Adler manuscript. And I don't know, I mean, it's really, it's not so clear. Actually, I was just now, participated in a conference and we talked about it. It's not so clear that was the right decision. It's hard to tell what is the right decision because, you know, we have manuscripts. We have the date of the manuscript, which is different from the date of the text. You understand? I mean, if a manuscript was written in the 15th century, it doesn't tell anything about the age of the text. The text could be coming from the 9th, from the 10th century. So we don't know. We don't know what Yeffet wrote. And some of the variants, that's a very interesting thing when you think about books that were written before printing. They all copies are not the same. There's always differences. And who introduced those differences? Was it the authors themselves or copyists or scribes? It's not clear, and you never know, you really almost never know what was the original text, and it may not even be a question that you need to ask. It's more what you have now and how you deal with it. Anyway, so my edition is an in-between eclectic and diplomatic. The next question that I had to deal with was what language, what writing system to put it in, because I have one manuscript written in Arabic script and the others in Hebrew script. So my editors wanted me to decide on one writing system and do that one. And again, I thought, you know, if I'm creating a critical edition, it has to reflect the manuscript as much as possible. So I resisted this, and I said, no, it has to be whatever it is. And in the end, it is. You can see that sometimes in the middle of a sentence, you switch between one manuscript to another, and also one writing system to another. I was thinking about, you know, in the 19th century, some people started publishing Yefet's work. So there was one publication of Song of Song by Barges, the French priest. All of his manuscripts were written in Hebrew script, but he wrote it all in Arabic. And when you look at his edition, you see that some assumptions that he made must have been a mistake. I mean, his edition has a lot of mistakes because he insisted on transliterating. The same is true for Averbach did the Yefet's Proverb chapter 30. Also, again, you can see that. So I didn't want to get into this trap where I would have to guess how they spelled words. So we did that. And then the other question was how to divide the material. And so people that published in this series before me published everything together, meaning the edition and the translation into English. So it would have been nice if I could do that too, but the volume. I was the first one that tackled 31 chapters, you know, Book of Proverbs. The other people were doing shorter books so they could put it together. Here, look, this is only the edition and introduction. It's a huge book. It's over 500 pages. So we had to separate to. So the translation is going to come up in the next volume. And the other question is that we were like thinking about is the apparatus. So some people that published in this series divided the apparatus into different segments, and I'm not even sure up until now why. Mine is only one apparatus, but also they published their apparatus in Hebrew. In other words, not just the lemmas, but the explanation, the wording are in Hebrew. It's in Hebrew, and it's not really clear because the edition is in Arabic. The paratext is in English, so why Hebrew? Hebrew is the only writing system, so it wasn't really clear to me. So really, you have to think, who is the reading? Who is the audience you're writing it for? If you write in English, if the paratext is in English, then why not? So anyway, mine is in English. It's very strange to see this. Like, I think Arabic makes more sense than Hebrew because the text is in Arabic. Anyway, so those were all these things that we had to think about. Now, other things more to the material itself. So, for instance, Yefet translates the Bible from Hebrew to Arabic. So he's moving within the Semitic world. So if he, and Yefet, now Yefet's translation is very different from Saadia's. Karaite's translations are very different from others because their goal wasn't to produce this beautiful translation that lends itself very nicely to the host language. What they wanted to do is they want to teach you the Hebrew. So their translation is like an aid, crutches for you to be able to learn Hebrew. So what they did is like they would most of the time translate word for word, keep the word order, try to keep cognates. And so the result of this was a very stiff wooden Arabic, but it didn't bother them because they wanted to reflect the Hebrew as much as they could. When I translated, I need to translate his Arabic translation into English. At first, I didn't pay attention to this, and I was really just recreating JPS translation or NRSV. But then it dawned on me that it's important to show this feature. So I went back and I tried to. But I'm going from Semitic language into Arabic, into English, so it's really very difficult to keep to word order and to keep it. But, you know, so my translation is going to be very wooden and stiff too, but, I try to reflect it as much as possible. We'll see. Another thing is is Yefet consistent about his, you know, the Book of Proverbs has a lot of terminology that repeats itself, like wisdom and the righteous and the Rasha, the evil and the, you know, the foreign and all sorts of, all these terms that keep on repeating themselves. Is Yefet consistent when he translates them? And how can I, how, to what degree can I be consistent with those things? So all these things, you know, and also interestingly, Yefet may be consistent. Let's say the fool, he always calls the fool a certain word, but it's interesting because in one of the manuscripts, the old, the Arabic written manuscript, the fool, the ksil, he is always translated as al-jahil, which means the ignorant. And in the others, it's translated as al-ahmak, which means the fool. So there is discrepancy between manuscripts. So what did Yefet really do here? And how do I reflect this in my translation? So all these questions that you need to deal with. Another feature of Yefet's translation is the expansion of the semantic field of words. And he does it because of a very specific reason. And I'll give you an example. The word orma in Hebrew means has two meanings. It's a polysemic word. It means cleverness in a positive meaning, and but also means cunning in a negative meaning. So, for instance, Saadia, when the word is positive, he'll use one Arabic word, and when it's negative, you know, he uses another. Yefet uses only one word. He takes the Arabic word khubth, which has a negative meaning, and he translates with it every time the word orma occurs in the Book of Proverbs. And the reason is he wants to show you that this is how it is in the Bible. But he forces the Arabic word to have a positive meaning as well. He expands the semantic field of the Arabic word. So how do I do this in English? Can I do the same thing that he does? How do I deal with this? Another thing, another feature that is that just like when we speak Hebrew, when we speak English, we use a lot of Hebrew words, like when we talk. So too, Yefet in his commentary uses a lot of Hebrew words, which he could really very easily use Arabic words. But the Chacham and the Rasha and all of these terms come in Hebrew. What do I do with this? How do I keep them in Hebrew? Do I translate them into English? All these things to consider. So these are questions that I had to deal with, and now I want to move to the last part, and which is to give you some idea of what kind the taste of his commentary. And I will start with the idea of wisdom. So chapter eight is all this chapter is. We have wisdom talking in the first person, talking about how she is, all her attributes and also her in relation to the story of creation. So on the one hand, Yefet has to deal with wisdom, and he, on the one hand, he presents the known conventional Rabbinite concept of wisdom, which is that God created wisdom, and wisdom was the Torah, and the Torah is the blueprint that God created the world according to. So that's one thing. You can see hints of this in his commentary in several places there. But also at the same time, when he wants to comment on Proverbs chapter 8, verse 22, Adonai kanani reshit darko, which is the Lord created me at the beginning of his way, he says, kanani is not like konei shamayim va'aretz. It's not in the same meaning as creation. It's not that God, and he translates kanani as malakani, meaning owns me or has me. It doesn't say created me, because he says that what he wants to say is that wisdom is an attribute of God, essential attribute, and that's a known Mu'tazilite Islamic theology, where God in the Mu'tazilite theology, they talk about a lot about what is God, and all they can say is what they don't know about God, because we don't know anything. God is unique and different from anything else on earth, and we don't know. But they do attribute two types of attributes to God. attributes of action and attributes of essence. An attribute of action would be, for instance, creation. God can create, but no other creature, no created creature can create. So it's unique to God. And attributes of essence include God is eternal, and God is alive, and God is omniscient, and God is omni, all the omnis, and God is wise also. So wisdom is, and all this, these are essential attributes. In other words, you cannot say God and the attribute. It's like it's all one thing. You can't separate between them. And Yefet reflects this when he talks about wisdom in his commentary on this chapter. So he puts together traditional rabbinic ideas and Mu'tazilite ideas. And it's not that Yefet went and read all these Mu'tazilite books and became, like, studied all this. These ideas were embedded in the theology of the time. People were, well, they felt like they owned it. They felt like, since there was no contradiction between Judaism and Islam on these questions, then they felt like they owned it. They felt like it was theirs as well. And Saadia as well expresses the same ideas. So it's interesting to see how he combines these two ideas in his commentary here. Another thing that I wanted to discuss is Yefet's awareness of the editorial process of the Book of Proverbs. So in his introduction to his commentary on the Book of Proverbs, he says in Arabic, it's very nicely, it says, Li Solomon, three books. So Solomon, to Solomon, there are three books. In other words, the Book of Proverbs is the Solomonic book. But he doesn't use the word wrote or whatever, or
so
composed.
It's attributed to.
Wait, he doesn't say attributed to. He says uses li, the lamed, which is perfectly good, because even in modern Arabic, if you say li Vivian, seven books, it means that you wrote seven books. That's the general understanding. It's this preposition that will reflect that. But in his commentary on the first verse of the book, he says, Nusi Bahadat book, this book was attributed to Solomon. That's when he was attributed. He doesn't say he wrote it. He says it's attributed to Solomon who uttered it. He didn't say who wrote it, but who said the book. So that's very interesting. This is a very interesting statement. He also says that the book includes the words, what is the Divrei Chachamim? It says in the first chapter, Divrei Chachamim. He says these are words of people, sages that preceded Solomon, that are also included in the book. And after the first nine chapters, he says, this is the end of the first part of the book. This part is so-and-so. This part goes by groups of verses, whereas from now on, every verse stands on his own. It's a different part. Then when he begins to write his commentary on chapter 10, he writes, this is the new section. He divides the book into five different sections. Proverbs 25, one where it says Gam ele Mishle Shlomo Sheretiku Anshe Chizkiya. So he says, okay, here is another group of things, here's another compilation. He acknowledges and he tries to write the historical moment where they were added. And what's really very nice is that chapter 31 begins with Lemuel's mother teaching her son what to do with women and wine. So he says, Lemuel, it must be Solomon, and Lemuel's mother is Bathsheba. She's teaching her son. And therefore, since Eshet Chayil, the woman of valor, is right after, this is her idea of what is the ideal woman. So she wrote this piece. So he attributes part of the book to a woman. That's really amazing. He also attributes the book of Esther to Esther. And so that brings me to the last point that I want to make, which is the egalitarian approach of Yefet, which is really very nice. You can see it in the book of Proverbs always talks about the parents, the mother and the father. So he says at one point, whatever is required from the father is also required from the mother and vice versa. So he makes it really clear that things have to be looked at egalitarian. Also, when there is a section there that talks about finding a good wife is nice. So he says also that a man should look for a woman of such and such, but a woman should look for, like, it's always like egalitarian, it's always like, it's not just one, it's not just the men go and look for women, but women also look for men and mm-hmm. have to look for certain attributes. Basically that's that's it.
Okay.
I'll end on this note. So.
Take questions and
sure.
comments.
Yeah.
The 9th century manuscript, or it was the 11th century.
11th century.
It's written on what?
On paper.
On paper. Yeah, because this is the transitional point when paper came into.
But I think in the Islamic world, as opposed to Europe, paper came in earlier.
The 8th century.
Right.
It came in the
already
8th century.
So by the 11th, it was the most common
type of writing material.
Yeah.
And I can't even read my notes. When you say that things were missing in the 11th century manuscript and that they filled in, do you mean that sections were missing or parts of sentences?
Okay, this may not have been clear. The 11th century manuscript only has half of the material, but nobody filled it in. The 17th century mm-hmm. manuscript was filled in by the scribe that wrote the 19th century manuscript. I know it's confusing.
But was it phrases that were missing or sections?
Pages. The beginning and the ends of books usually.
Yeah, they get worn out.
Yeah, so that's those. And I think there was one page or two pages in the middle of it, the Adler.
And do you think the point you made, that Solomon uttered the book, that reminds me of the fact that the Quran is taught orally.
Mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm,
do you
mm-hmm.
think that there's an influence
connection.
There?
That's
and then the way he translates.
That's a good question. I didn't think about it that way. For me, what it meant was Solomon didn't write it. People after him wrote it, and the book had to go through some editorial process. Solomon maybe uttered those things, but somebody else had to write them. This is my feeling of what he means.
But the fact that the giving of the text
is oral. Right.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's a great point.
It has many parallels.
Yeah, it's a great point. Yeah, I didn't think about it. No, that's great. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, thanks.
Are you finished with your English translation?
No, I'm still working on it.
So when you were going through and talking about the challenge of the English translation, you said, I mean, the way you presented it was, do I do this or do I do that?
Yeah.
Can you tell us what some of your decisions were?
Sure. So, for instance, his Hebrew words. At first, I thought I'd put them in, but then I thought it would be too cumbersome to put them in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
After all, whom am I writing it? I'm writing it for people that don't understand
mm-hmm.
Arabic. I assume they also don't understand Hebrew, because if they understood Hebrew, they would go look for a Hebrew translation. They wouldn't read it. So I decided not to. And unless, in some cases, Yefet makes a point, when he puts the Hebrew, he wants to make a point. And in those cases,
mm-hmm.
I will either have a footnote or put in brackets, but not on a regular basis when he just decides that it's easier for him to say chacham instead of wise. I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not sure this was the right decision. I know other people that did published in the series, Dafka actually did put the Hebrew, and maybe it's better. I don't know. I finished a translation in the sense that I have a draft for the entire translation, but I haven't. I have to still go and clean it. Other decisions, like I don't remember what are the questions. For instance, with his expansion of meaning. So I have a footnote that, of course, you have to.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly with footnotes, I would deal with this.
Do you know how many copies are they printing, and what does that tell us about the Brill? Yeah, how many copies are they printing, and what does that tell us about the size of the audience for this kind
That's
of
very good
scholarship?
Question. Look, these books are not meant for individuals; they're meant for libraries. They're so expensive. They told me the contract that I signed with them is that they are going to make 200, the first
mm-hmm.
200, and then if they do more,
mm-hmm.
then I'm eligible for whatever.
loyalty.
Right.
Yeah, but I doubt very much that, even though we all made this effort to buy the copies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 200.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It might be interesting to hear a few words on a large topic, if you could, about Judeo-Arabic and Yefet's way of writing in Judeo-Arabic.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that this is Arabic language written in Hebrew script.
Right.
So there are issues of orthography where you don't have all the same consonants,
right,
but also it's not the same language as classical Arabic.
Right.
There are differences there.
Very good question. Thanks. So first of all, unfortunately, we don't have any autographic manuscript of Yefet, any, none.
Mm.
We don't know how he wrote. We don't know in what script he wrote. We know that the Jews in general wrote Arabic in Hebrew letters, just like Yiddish and Ladino and Persian. That's what the Jews did because they went to school. First they went to Cheder. This was their first language. So, and they used it. A, it was easier. B, it could be used as a secret language because the Muslim wouldn't understand. So, yeah. So we don't know how he wrote. We know that Karaites experimented for a short period in the 11th century and they wrote in Arabic. This is why we have this one manuscript in Arabic. They wrote other things in for a short period of time. This is documented. I think Jeffrey Khan wrote a lot about it. So before Saadia Gaon, when the Jews wrote Judeo-Arabic in Hebrew letters, Joshua Blau calls it phonetic writing, and which means that there were no laws, there were no rules, and they wrote, whichever they wanted. Not everybody knew the conversion, the origins. You know, all Semitic languages have the sounds, the phonemes are coming from the same origin, but they didn't know historical linguistics, so they didn't know how to do it, so they wrote whichever way came to them. For instance, at the end of a lot of words in Arabic, you have ahui letters like waw, vav, and aleph, or yud, and they would choose whichever they wanted because in Arabic it's pretty much, I mean, it's different laws, but you know, it's more whatever. It lends itself to use differently. So, Saadia is attributed with standardizing Judeo-Arabic. So after from him on, there are more standards. So yeah, Hebrew has only 22 characters or 23, and Arabic has 28. So you had to adapt, and with the diacritics, they were able to do it, and they were very consistent. Did I answer a question?
Or? Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And I mean, since you didn't actually comment on the substance of his commentary, is there anything you would want to say about kind of outstanding features of his approach to commentary?
Well, so he says that he's going to be very literal, but everybody says that. And it's interesting. He is more literal than Midrash, for sure, but he's not so. He goes on with the text very nicely. He adds and he expands the text, and he it's very nice. For instance, the Proverbs 6:6, this is Lechel Nemala Atzel, the go to the end, lazy one, see how, whatever the rest of it is. So he has a whole beautiful story there where he starts talking with the Atzel, with the lazy person, and he goes back and forth, as if Solomon talks to the lazy person, and they go back and forth. There's a whole conversation there. I don't know. But it is basically, I think it's pretty literal. I mean, there's no big things. But in some places he does get into polemics. But his polemics, it's interesting, in the book of Proverbs, I don't see much polemics against Rabbinites. It's more polemics against Christians and Muslims, or there is a nice polemics against, actually this could be Rabbinites, it's against people that use all sorts of medications, and they use food that's not allowed in the because it's medication, so he says, no, you can't use that. But in general, he's not so polemical in his commentary on the Book of Proverbs. I guess this is one of the later books that he commented on. So his polemics is mostly in his commentaries on the Pentateuch.
Mm-hmm. How much of his Bible commentary do we preserve?
All of it exists in manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
What was published up until now is a part of Genesis. Joshua, only his translation, some of the minor prophets like Hosea was published, and many of them are now in the making. I know Haggai, Amos, Malachi, Ovadia was already, just one chapter, so that was easy. There's a guy who works on Ezra, Nehemiah in Chronicles, I know. Shir HaShirim was done a while ago. What else? Job is being worked on, so this is a big, big production now. Daniel was done already.
Esther
was done, right? Thanks. And Ruth was done, beautiful. And, yeah.
Are you going to do another one?
No. I'm done.
Anybody else? Okay. Well, Ilana, thank you so much.
Thank you all for coming.
Really wonderful work, and congratulations on its publication.
Thanks.